Alan and June Booth, who are going to give us some information and an update on discussions on their project, History Teaching with Passion.
Yeah, absolutely. As some of you may know, for the last 6 months we've been collecting information about history teachers and their experiences of teaching the subject in higher education. And in some ways, the stories that have come out are highly personal, and the most personal bits have been when we asked, what alternative careers would you pursue? And while some people said, well, we'd be a teacher in another setting, and some said, I honestly can't imagine doing anything else, or I don't know, I'm a lifer, would anyone have me? I'd probably be a job seeker. There were others who wrote some rather strange and wonderful things about what they would do in an alternative life. I've always fancied dry stone walling, a professional sailor, building deer fences in Scotland, an entrepreneur or worse, a stand-up comedian, the same ability to make the audience laugh or cry. So there are a whole range of rather individual responses, but we also found some real commonalities in the ideals and aspirations and experiences that people had teaching the subject. And this project represents our attempt, I suppose we should say, to explore these in order to encourage conversation about key issues to do with the teaching and learning of history in higher education, to provide bibliographic and digital resources, and to generate ideas about practice, both now and in the future. These were the questions that we set ourselves when we set off on this rather strange journey into the world of academic historians as teachers. What motivates historians as teachers, and how does their love of the subject relate to that? How does it influence their hopes and ideals? What difference does history teaching make, and how can we make that case to wider publics? What sort of teaching engages students deeply? And how do historians view their development as teachers? What influenced them? And particularly, what advice do they have for those starting out now as teachers of the subject in universities and higher education? The methods that we used really included a national online survey of UK historians, particularly those based directly in history departments, filmed individual interviews and group discussions, and a review of the literature. And this filming, as some of you will be painfully aware, is ongoing, as you get asked by those reprobates who are now filming to do short interviews with them. But please cooperate, because it will be really helpful to new generations of historians teaching to see the mistakes that have been made by more experienced colleagues. Today we're going to focus particularly on the survey. And as you can see from this diagram, we had 210 responses to the survey from historians at all stages of their career, and in 72 different institutions in all. And to me, this was an amazing response, because I had said to Jean that we'd probably get about 20 back, because people would just delete the email questionnaire. As it happened, they didn't, and they filled it in. Some may have done. as it is, many of them filled it in, and in more detail than I would have imagined. You'll notice, by the way, that 42% were men, 38% women, and 20% refused to say whether they were men or women. Okay, in this the presentation that we've got, we're going to focus on the two questions on the survey that really related to this particular conference themes. There's a whole lot of other data that's there. But we wanted to begin by just taking out some broad headlines from the survey about how teachers, history teachers, engaged with teaching the subject. And a key message that came out through the responses was that love of the subject is regarded as essential to good teaching, teaching that people characterise in words like enthusiasm, commitment, energy, passion, etc. What comes out is that teaching history isn't simply seen or experienced as an intellectual thing. It's also quite a highly emotional journey of the sort that we don't talk about as much as I think we should do. Look at the subject and enthusiasm for communicating it are closely allied in the responses. Some people say that these are synonymous. And this exchange is represented not as a simple act of transmission from the tutor, the teacher, to the students, but as a relationship, as a constructive interaction from which both of them, both the teacher and the student, gain in terms of what's often mentioned are ideas, insights, knowledge, and also motivation. This is what seems to make teaching for many meaningful work. And love of the subject constitutes an important bridge between the tutor and the students that can transform lives. And it's this transformation that seems really important to people, this making a difference. And many of them seem to witness it in terms of penny dropping moments or light bulb moments. They talk about this quite often. And you can see some of these things from these illustrations. I teach history because I love it. In teaching it, you have the sense you're opening minds to things they never considered previously. I want to inspire an enduring love of history. I really get a kick out of seeing students develop, particularly to the point where they don't need me anymore. I like the fact I can make a difference to so many lives. And then some light bulb moments. These are often mentioned, more often than you'd think. Seeing the light bulb above their heads when they understand what the study of history is all about. When they've made that qualitative leap. The moment when the penny drops, you can sense someone's begun to understand how to think historically. I particularly enjoy it when it's meaningful in some way, beyond the usual skills. Sometimes there's a flash of recognition when they see their past, their community, their own life and their future differently. Now, often this making a difference is expressed in terms of undergraduate students, and that's probably because of the way we couch the question. But some people talk about it in terms of the wider public and engagement with wider publics as well. And one says, I get the same satisfaction from working with young children, local history classes, university groups, and research students. And the same themes that we've been talking about are evident in the interviews that we did with international historians, and you're just going to see a few of those.
In some respects, one day I woke up and realised that being an academic historian involves that practice in your discipline and also teaching. And the two became one. I didn't see that there was a distinction between them. And I increasingly began to enjoy it, especially when I moved out of simply tutoring other people's courses and into my own courses, where I could much more clearly see the connection with my disciplinary practice and the teaching, because I was designing the courses, I was writing the lectures. And I think that's where the passion from the discipline began to inform my teaching.
I love the interactions with people. I love seeing the changes. I like to see the light bulb light up. I like the fact that it's an open-ended profession. I mean, I've been doing it all these years, and I feel like my learning curve is deeper than it's ever been before. I think that each year now I'm better than the previous year, more better than I've ever been before. And that's exciting. It opens up. It's unlimited.
Okay, so what we want to focus on now is on the answers to the people made to questions 7 and 8. These are questions 7 and 8. These bear most directly, I think, on the theme of this conference. And they also explain in a bit more detail about the sort of making a difference to students that people are thinking about. So we're going to start with some illustrative quotes from the survey. We had an awful lot of quotes, quite long quotes, from the survey. And I don't know who's going to start with this. Sarah is going to start.
Hey, history teaching can encourage students to think about the past or distant societies and reflect what it may mean for both the human experience and for today. History in many ways is uniquely placed to ask the big questions societies face and arguably to point to solutions, challenges and impacts. It crosses every aspect of human activity, from culture to the environment to gender relations, economics, welfare, nation building, the list could go on.
History education cultivates people useful to a democratic society. It's not enough to have practical skills. How those skills are imparted to others and how our graduates shape the opportunities for others are all determined by an ability to be fair, open-minded, see other people's views, to see false or dangerous arguments, and to be empowered to act upon those things.
Students get the realisation that they are the heirs of a vastly complex and messy thing called humanity. History gives students the understanding that humans are irrational and illogical. That is necessary in coming to grips with the horrors found in history, but it's also essential in the appreciation of great beauties, the great triumphs that we as human beings have been capable of.
History students acquire a deep sense of the contours of the past. They realise that events are never simple and straightforward, but instead highly nuanced. They learn to appreciate that decision-making is fraught with risk because the outcomes are never clear to the participants. And they learn to differentiate what matters between what matters and what does not. This helps them to reach conclusions on imperfect information and remain flexible and to improvise when required. In a fast-changing world, the creation of a group of people with those capabilities is vital to the future success of the nation.
The study of history encourages people to think critically, to refuse to accept things as they appear on the surface. It produces individuals who are aware of the complexity of issues that confront society. History graduates have a greater sense, not only of the world they live in, but how it got there. Ultimately, this can only make for better citizens.
History teaching encourages not only critical, but creative ways of looking and an ethical imagination. Without history, we would be reduced to a society which had deprived itself of a key compass with which to navigate the complexities of our own world or imagine futures in an evidence-based way. Without the self-reflexive qualities history education provides, we would be left with traditions we could not properly understand or use.
Okay, thank you to our historical actors there, you know. A great job. You'll be paid later. Possibly. Okay, as you can imagine from these quotations, and there were an awful lot of them, breaking them down was quite difficult. Codifying them proved more difficult than I think either of us had imagined. But when we did so, what it seemed to suggest that was that history teaching is at its best made a difference beyond a simple iteration of skills or acquisition of knowledge. And even critical thinking didn't quite capture it. It was almost too abstract in some ways, or reduced to a set of technical competences or capabilities. What I think we see in the responses is a much richer representation of student development, we like to suggest. History teaching as arguably a particular or distinctive kind of people formation, if you like, as cultivating a way of being in the world, of knowing, experiencing, and acting. And we've tried to capture this in the next two slides. Using the words that we get from all the responses, try to work with them and interpret them. We came out with this, really, the history teaching at its best. These responses suggest cultivates people who understand society themselves and themselves in broader, deeper, and longer perspective. One person says in 3D, and another person with an expanded terms of reference. People who view society in multifaceted and interconnected ways. One person says considering political, economic, social, cultural, and other factors together. And one says a holistic study of the world without being beholden to any particular theory. And people who are sensitive to the strangeness of others, to the impossibility of knowing them entirely, but also their common humanity. People who've got a grip on very different frames of human reference. And also people who are attentive to the complexity of structures, events, circumstances. The dynamic nature of society, one person says, sensitive to constant change and flux, to the messiness of events, and also aware of contingency, contradictions, the illogicality, the unpredictability, these are all the words that they use, of individuals' decisions and the influences of those, that nothing is inevitable. And people who are attuned to the partiality, the contextuality of information and knowledge, of evidence and explanatory models, of traditions and the taken for granted. And finally, people who are sensitive to the complexity of making judgment, to considering multiple and conflicting perspectives, they say, to the play of language, to the need to connect evidence to context, and to avoid rushing to judgment. And also people who display some key personal attributes. And I've grouped these into three, partly because I like three, but partly because I will argue here that they do fall into three. The descriptive words that are behind these are critical disposition, sympathetic imagination, and a will to learn and keep learning. Those words and phrases that are behind those are the words that people use in the survey. And you can read them for yourself. So it seems to us that the responses to the survey suggest that history, teaching at its best, has the potential to cultivate a particular form of engaged mindfulness, the sort of awareness that the Harvard psychologist Ellen Langer talks about in her empirical work on high-quality learning and living well. The sort of capabilities that philosophers interested in higher education, like Martha Nussbaum and Ronald Barnett, talk about as essential to a revitalized higher education for the 21st century. And the sort of things that social theorists, like those involved in the New Economics Foundation, are talking about as a coherent way for higher education, both today and in the future. And it also aligns with what I recently read from two American educationalists, Sullivan and Roizen, who are talking about the development and the importance of what they call practical reason as part of the revitalization of US liberal higher education. So it seems to us that the responses to question 7 have an authenticity about them and give voice to what we think is a potentially powerful statement of the value of what we do as history teachers. That at its best, history teaching cultivates people who can engage with the complexities of self, others, and the world in sensitive, purposeful, and passionate, but also compassionate ways. However, in response to question 8, how would you describe the value of these things to policymakers? They seem to lose confidence in that, I wonder why, in that vocabulary of value, and begin to resort to a heavily skills-based vocabulary and a much more technicist vocabulary. And this Wordle, which counts the frequency of all the words used in response to question 8, points that out a little bit. And you can see there that skills are very prominent. Thank you to Sean for introducing us to the Wordle experience. And it's also revealed in the following quotations from the survey.
These are essential skills, all valuable to free market and enterprise economy.
I would describe the study of history as a superb method of producing an inquisitive, innovative and flexible workforce.
Sadly, I would try to speak to policymakers on their own terms, parroting the seemingly relentless business skills agenda.
We gave you that one specifically. It just seemed appropriate. Okay. Host.
I'm worried that we repeatedly articulate the value of what we do in terms largely dictated by the Treasury view, rather than seek to challenge the terms of debate.
If we instrumentalise the study of history to please policymakers in 2010, we will simply have to change our language when the policymakers of 2011 change theirs. Hitching our wagons to transient stars won't save us, but nor should we loftily trumpet ivory tower values.
I'm extremely concerned that policymakers and university managers will opt for the measurable and ignore the less tangible, in particular, the development of students as independent learners.
Okay, so many of the people who responded to the survey felt compelled to use language that doesn't really come close to adequately reflecting the values that they expressed in response to question 7. And yet it seemed to us that the values expressed there and the aspirations for the kinds of people cultivated by history teaching at its best, these are the things that better prepare graduates to thrive in the kinds of lives that they'll be living. And it's this voice that needs to be amplified, we think. So let's look at the kinds of lives that graduates will be living and entering into.
So let's look first at how they will be making a living. And let's face it, most of us have to make a living. And you'll be aware that globalisation, new technologies, have been dramatically changing how work is organised, its nature, and the pattern that individual careers will take. Traditional large companies have become flatter, leaner, using more part-time staff, outsourcing more, and using flexible contracts, using people on very much a plug-and-play basis. And recently, indeed over the next few weeks, we're seeing large-scale redundancies, particularly in the public sector. And this is going to hit graduate employment hard, particularly north of London. But traditional recruitment into the kind of conventional graduate training programs has been declining significantly for some time now. The Association of Graduate Recruiters, which represents about 750 of the mainly larger corporations, including 80 of the FTSE 100, and most of the large public sector recruiters, such as health, education, local government, now have vacancies for less than 10% of the annual graduating force in the UK. And two-thirds of those vacancies can actually be done by students, graduates of any discipline. So historians are competing with each other and with thousands of others, graduates, for a smaller number of those traditional opportunities. In fact, you may not be aware, but 99% of all UK enterprises actually employ less than 50 people now. And that accounts for almost half the workforce in the UK. In fact, 75% of all UK enterprises actually don't employ anybody except themselves. And if you look at the qualifications levels of those sole proprietorships, they're actually level 3 and above. They're kind of skilled people. So when we think about the kinds of careers that history graduates will go into, we often think of very kind of traditional things: teaching, law, research, accountancy, journalism, admin. But when we look at the actual work that they go into, we might feel that there is a different story. Now, some of you will have seen this before, This is history graduates from 2009, which is actually the latest stats we've got. This is 6 months following graduation, and you can see from this there's just under half are actually going into full-time employment, and we've got 14.4% studying for a higher degree, 3.5% going into postgraduate teaching. And if we look at the breakdown of that employment, that 47% employment, this is how it looks. So at the moment, we've got nearly a quarter going into retail or bar work, 15% into clerical and secretarial, and 18%, or virtually 18%, into a real rag bag of what we call other occupations, which for 2009 included things like personal training and so on. What I will say is don't despair, because almost everybody would say that taking the stats at 6 months after graduation are virtually meaningless. Although I have to say that these are the measures that are going to be required by the Higher Education Funding Council to be published in the public domain as part of the key information set for higher education institutions. But if you look at the longitudinal surveys that look at graduate destinations over a longer period, over 70% are in graduate kind of level jobs after about 3.5 years, although not on permanent contracts. And if you look further still, as Dave Nichols has done in his research on famous history graduates, which has been published on the History Subject Centre website, and he's recently done an update to that, there are plenty of historians enjoying high positions in Parliament, banking, major corporations, although it has to be said that many of those entered those kinds of careers through the sorts of graduate training programs that are actually accessible to very few now. And also, most of them came from Cambridge, Oxford, and similar institutions. However, whilst we can say that those kinds of routes are available to very few graduates now, an interesting problem that Dave Nichols turned up in his research into famous history graduates was that many of them had had more than one career, so he couldn't actually codify them in terms of occupations. And what history actually may have done was equip them to actually pursue a multiplicity of careers. Now, there's nothing new in that. You know, we've always said that a history degree can actually prepare you for all kinds of things. But what we haven't quite appreciated is that it's increasingly the case that an individual will have a very diverse range of careers within their own lifetime. Now, our reactions when we see the destination stats and when we consider the competition for fewer graduate jobs is to work on employability skills to ensure that historians can actually compete with others. So we try and find out what it is that employers want, and we ensure that we've put those into the kind of programs, and we also start to talk about things in a language that we expect business and employers will understand. Now, this is important and valuable work, and I know many of you are actually engaged in that. But we also need to understand that current employers know little more about their future needs than anyone else does. Now, this is a comment from Richard Lambert, who's the former director of the Confederation of British Industry. And he said, and this was in November last year, "It's impossible to predict what disciplines will be of most economic and social value in a rapidly changing world. Most of the big breakthroughs in the development of products and services these days come from collaboration among different disciplines." Now, he didn't say multidisciplinary, he said collaboration among different disciplines. Now, I will have to say that Richard Lambert, of course, is a historian, and so is his successor as the Director General of the CBI. In fact, this is increasingly what it's like trying to make a living in a constantly changing, unpredictable world. Lewis Carroll probably described it best. Alice, our graduate, was bewildered by what she confronted. A croquet ground that was all ridges and furrows. The balls were live hedgehogs, the mallets were live flamingos, and the soldiers formed the hoops by bending over, touching the ground. Alice's first difficulty was handling her flamingo. She succeeded in getting its body tucked away, comfortably enough, under her arm, but generally, just as she got its neck nicely straightened out and was going to give the hedgehog a blow with its head, it would twist itself round. When it got its head down and was going to begin again, it was very provoking to find that the hedgehog had unrolled itself and was in the act of crawling away. Alice's problems didn't stop there, though. She found that wherever she wanted to send the hedgehog, a ridge or a furrow was in its place. And the soldiers kept on standing up and walking away. Alice came to the conclusion that this was a very difficult game, indeed. Now, this is the world that your graduates are going to try to make a living in. And like Alice, they're on their own. It's increasingly unlikely that they'll be taken under the wing of a paternal employer and pursue a linear pathway, even if they start out like that. In fact, if we bring the imagery up to date a little bit more, here's the moving staircase from Hogwarts and Harry Potter. Now, this is the kind of career your graduates are looking at. No sooner have they started up that stairway than it will move. So maybe, whilst we obviously need to pay attention to what employers may say they want, we also need to pay even more attention to what will actually prepare graduates to thrive in these kinds of conditions. So what is it that history teaching, at its best, can give Alice to help her in the complex, constantly changing world she's in? There are virtually no rules or no predictable ways of making a living anymore, or not ones that will last a lifetime anyway. Continuing to make a living throughout one's life requires interaction with all kinds of people and agents that all actually interact with each other and constantly adapt to the conditions around them. The outcomes are complex and unpredictable. With any luck, creativity, innovation, adaptability, work that someone will pay for may actually emerge. But they're not by any means the only possible outcomes. And the only influence Alice can have is in the way that she actually holds herself and the position that she takes on her interactions with others. To thrive in this complex, unpredictable world, these are some of the things that the key things that researchers are saying are going to be needed. On the left-hand side, still the left-hand side here, are some of the attributes that Lee Harvey suggests are needed. They're going to need to be able to relate to, make and maintain relationships with people at all levels, inside and outside of organisations. To collaborate and work in teams, and work in more than one team at once, and adjust their roles in an ever-shifting situation. They're going to need to be willing to learn, and continually learn and take risks. Lead and deal with change, but also help others to do so. And to be able to manage themselves, be self-confident, and be able to promote themselves. So thriving in complexity is all about relationships with others and with oneself. On the right is the outcomes of very recent research from Warwick Institute of Employment Research. And they were looking at changing patterns of working, learning, and career development in 10 countries, actually, across Europe. They argued that we focus an awful lot on employer need for the knowledge economy. We've all heard about the kind of knowledge economy stuff. And policymakers have highlighted the need for individuals to develop additional skills knowledge and understanding. But what individuals are going to need in addition to continue to be able to make a living is the ability to recontextualize their skills, knowledge and understanding, to transfer them between different settings. The Warwick actually talks about a concept of flexicurity. That's a new word, you can start using. Flexicurity. Being able to flex what you can do in different ways to create work of value. Something somebody will pay for, because that's actually the only security that you have. And interestingly, if we go back to those slides that Alan showed earlier, you can see that what history teachers aspire to do in history teaching at its best is actually much closer to what graduates are going to need to prepare them to make a living than the narrower employability skills that are also important, but they're a subset, they're not quite enough. I'll just give you a moment just to have a look at those and perhaps just reflect on how it kind of fits with what graduates are going to need to be able to thrive. But of course, making a living is not just about money. It's not just about earning money. And there's increasing evidence that students have more in common with the values expressed by our history teachers. It's worth taking a closer look at this. This is the Tuxedo Times Higher Education University Lifestyle Survey, which reported about this time last year. Because it sheds light on why people choose to come to university. And as you can see, the overwhelming majority in the survey of 2,000, this was 2,000 full-time undergraduates, said that they came to improve job opportunities. And there's nothing surprising really about that, although we've got a position where more graduates are taking jobs that we might not have considered hitherto as at graduate level. You do need to be a graduate to be in the game now. So yes, people come to improve their job opportunities, but that's not just about money. 58% said that they came to improve their salary prospects, but just a fraction less also said that they wanted to improve their knowledge in an area of interest. And Dave Nichols' work, again, looking at undergraduates and why they chose to come to study history, said, I guess something which will be very familiar to all of you, that most of them actually chose to do a subject that they were interested in and loved to do. The independent think tank and research institute, the Demos, their survey last year of the class of 2010 shows that graduates actually view university much more as a preparation for life than a preparation for work. And the language that they actually use to do so is far removed from the dominant HE policy language. Also in the Demos survey, and indeed other research into the kinds of companies that graduates want to work for, suggest that what they're looking for is good work. Doing stuff that they enjoy and they care about and will actually make a difference in some way. They want to work with people with whom they share values, with flat structures so they can use their own initiatives and do things. They can develop themselves. They want to work in ethical and sustainable operations. They think economically, but economics as if the people and the planet mattered. And they want to be working and collaborating and sharing with teams. In fact, increasingly, we're seeing more people actually starting businesses. This is a quite small percentage of those, particularly for the statistics that we've got, which are only the 6 months after graduation. But over the last two years, we've seen a 46% increase in graduates starting their own businesses. More do so from the arts and humanities than from business studies or economics. And a third of those starting businesses actually start social enterprises. Now, we can't predict. We can kind of anticipate and think about how things may change with the double whammy of tuition fees and withdrawal of teaching support for history, and indeed for the whole of the arts and humanities. But our argument is that history teaching at its best provides the best preparation for the kinds of lives they're going to be living. So how can we represent that argument to students, their parents, their family, and others?
Oh, that's me. Yeah. Okay, very quickly then. These are some of the things we think we might do in terms of representing history teaching in ways that amplify how it goes beyond skills and employability, though includes them to prepare graduates to make a good living. Ways that draw more deeply on the values and ideals that anchor us, or seem to anchor us from the survey as teachers, and are shared, as Jean said, by many students. Ways that appeal to the emotional as well as the intellectual engagement that they and we have with the subject. Ways that demonstrate what one of the people responding to the survey said, the particularity of the kind of people that history teaching at its best might cultivate. Ways that draw upon a richer vocabulary that expresses how history teaching fosters the will to learn and to go on learning, a language that might include passion, excitement, etc. in it. And we think that's important. And ways that demonstrate practically and explicitly how history teaching at its best enables students to navigate the kinds of lives that they'll be experiencing in what is an increasingly changing, complex, etc. world. Those were just some ideas. We wanted finally to end with some hopeful and positive advice from people responding to the survey to their new or starting selves. What advice would they give to themselves if they were starting now? And these are some of the things that they said.
Try not to be discouraged by the widespread human resources and management speak, the constant misery reported by the Times Higher, and the general climate of gloom and doom in higher education in Britain. Cherish idealism rather than the current trend to make all things vocational, and you will find students and their parents, to whom we genuinely owe our calling, respond.
Try as hard as possible to ignore human resources inspired nonsense, the RAE, REF culture of publish any old rubbish and jump on whatever the latest bandwagon is. And be true to yourself and to the intellectual curiosity, idealism and general human decency of your students.
Be yourself. Don't try and pretend to be someone you're not. Use this as strength in your teaching. Be natural and don't be afraid of what others might think or say about you. Allow your passion for the subject to shine out. Students will love it, and you'll be true to yourself.
He said that with such conviction that I don't want to make any further comment on it. We wanted to leave it there on an idealistic, really, on a note of ideals, the sort of ideals that were expressed throughout the survey, despite a degree of pessimism expressed about the conditions in higher education at the moment. In the next session tomorrow, if anybody is left towards at the end of the day, we're going to be looking at what practical teaching strategies people might use to actually enable this to happen, to cultivate students as the sort of learners and people that we've been talking about. But I guess now, because Lisa's looking at me fiercely, it must be time to finish and engage with any questions that there are from the audience. Thank you.